You're listening to All the Best. I'm Michael Bryden, and it's the start of whale watching season. Look off the coast of Queensland or New South Wales in May, and maybe, if you're lucky, you'll be able to see them, and it'll be well worth the while. Most people prefer the beach in summer, but not me. It's more magical in winter, grey and moody, with hopefully the plumes of water shooting out on the horizon. Here's an episode we aired last year, near the end of whale watching season.
What you have is less than what your grandparents did, but more than what your children have. But each one of you all think that everything is good.
You're listening to All the Best. I'm Michaela Morgan, and today we're all about whales. Our grandparents might have expected to see 100 whales in a season, where today we might expect to see 10. Whatever we remember from when we were kids becomes the norm, and anything beyond that is unusual or forgotten. This is Mary Gardner, talking to Features EP Jess O'Callaghan.
I'm a writer, a biologist, a researcher. I live in Byron Bay. I write for the Byronshire Echo, and I'm also doing my PhD in historical marine ecology, trying to piece together what was the ocean like in days gone by. Changes get forgotten. What was the ocean like in the past? How do we remember a time when it was more abundant, when we actually forget all the time?
Someone, say 300 years ago, at this time of year, sort of looking out into the ocean from Byron Bay,
They would have seen probably between 12 to 15 different kinds of whales, four or five different species of dolphins. They may have seen dugongs. They would have seen an awful lot more turtles and sharks. It was a great preponderance of whales. And you have to imagine what this means. These are animals that are even larger than some of the dinosaurs we're so excited about. And they're traveling through water, they're going up and down, they're jumping, they're splashing about, they're getting together in big groups, they're breaking up, they're traveling up and down the country, they're eating, they're also pooing. And it's all these things that change the ocean. They change actually the quality of the water. How can you lose creatures that big and not see a difference? What have we missed? What's changed?
We'll hear more from Mary later on in the show, but now we travel to Melbourne, where an independent theatre company has just taken on an enormous challenge.
That white whale must be the same as some called Moby Dick.
Moby Dick? Do you know the white whale then?
At 650 pages, or 140 chapters, Herman Melville's classic novel Moby Dick is dauntingly long. So I was relieved to find out Melbourne Independent Theatre Company Until Monstrous were putting on a production of the book. According to the play's director, Rowan Byrne, who adapted the book into a theatre script, he and Until Monstrous did the work for the audience.
That is a really blunt sort of summary of the fundamental raison d'etre of this play, which is a lot of people aren't going to get around to reading the book, but they will come to see a 2-hour and 20-minute play in which other people, you know, in which someone has invested months of time selecting the important content and curating it, and a whole other team of people have spent an enormous amount of time and spent time before your very eyes and effort before your very eyes chewing the food for you. And
Rowan spent months adapting Moby Dick for the stage.
When I first sat down to start adapting the book, and I opened up to page one, and page one is etymology of the word whale. And I'm like, okay, skip. Hang on. I can't start trying to adapt this book by saying, no, I can't do that. That'd be the wrong footing on which to start this journey. So I said, well, here's a page full of extracts from different dictionaries about the word whale. How do I adapt that for stage? And we did find a way to adapt it for stage, and it's the opening scene of our play.
From the west,
Whale, from the Swedish and Danish val. The animal is named for roundness or rolling. For in Danish, hvalt is arched or vaulted.
Well, my Richardson says it's more immediately from the German and Dutch wollen, as in to roll, to wallow.
It's a reminder to me that we are a faithful adaptation, that we didn't get to page one and say no, we got to page one and said yes.
Early in the rehearsal schedule for Moby Dick, Show Thyself, the cast converged around a piano in a room above Union Theatre at Melbourne University.
Oh, Santiago gained a day along the plains of Mexico, 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 way Santiago. Oh, Mexico is a place I know along the plains of Mexico.
Liam Bellman-Sharp was co-director, sound designer, and composer for the production. He invited me to sit in on the chorus rehearsal. Their voices are quiet, but they grow in volume and confidence over the hour I spend listening to them. Liam acts as vocal coach to this bunch of rowdy sea hands. They break out into siren sounds. It's eerie and transfixing. Herman Melville's Moby Dick follows Ahab, one-legged captain of the ship the Pequod, his leg now residing in the belly of a white whale. Despite first mate Starbuck and the ship's crew pleading with Ahab to abort the ill-fated whaling mission, Ahab is blind with visions of revenge. References are made to a voyage 3 years earlier, where the white whale ate Ahab's leg. Since then, he has become obsessed by the hunt. He limps across the boat on a stump of a leg.
Death to Moby Dick!
Ahab's guiding motivation is he was attacked by a sperm whale. He's basically taken something that you would call an act of God and said, well, if this is an act of God, then I can hold God responsible.
Rowan says Until Monstrous have invited audiences to join the Pequod's crew on what is ultimately a devastatingly misguided voyage.
The audience has a sort of almost a bird's eye view, a God's eye view, really. Their senses of sort of floating above the ship and being eavesdropping on what happens there, which is indicative of the main theme of the play, which is the idea of there being a supernatural power, and the idea that you can believe so fully in a supernatural power, but it doesn't need to reveal itself.
The production is somber and almost seasick. In one gruesome scene, we have a view and the squelching sound of whale meat being carved, dissected, and harvested for money and for food. It's stomach-churning. Although Captain Ahab, and by extension the Pequod's crew, desperately and feverishly hunt Moby Dick, the white whale, throughout their voyage they are also hunting multiple anonymous creatures.
I am here, in this critical ocean, to kill whales for my living, not to be killed by them, for they are.
Whose side are we on here? Are we barracking for Ahab to get his just revenge? Do we want the crew returned safely home? Or do we side with the innocence of nature and the whale? I found myself wanting the whale to be something more than just a whale. I wanted the reassurance of a symbol or higher significance.
So is the audience the whale? Do you think the whale is a physical manifestation of fate?
But as Rowan and Liam both tell me, I was wrong.
Yeah, the whale is a whale, first and foremost. It's made of flesh. It's an animal. And that's a very important thing to remember.
The whale's just a whale. Ahab certainly seems to think of it as that, but the whale is just a whale, and I think that's really important to the text. You know, the idea of the whale is something else, but the whale itself is just this really kind of big goddamn whale that kills a lot of people. You know, kind of no different to a rogue elephant, but people do project all this significance onto it. And certainly the significance of it to Ahab is the idea of fate or of God or of a number of different things. you know, you could say anything about it. I think perhaps, you know, to Ahab the whale is the, you know, the manifestation of anything that stands in opposition to his own will, I suppose. Like, you know, there's some force in the universe, some nebulous force that stops people from doing, you know, from living as they might want to, or from, you know, being exactly as they might want to. And the whale is perhaps the manifestation, physically, metaphorically, symbolically, of that, in some ways, whether you want to call that fate or God or anything. I think that's kind of what the whale's getting at.
There's no straightforward way to represent fate on stage, but through the production's eerie and unnerving soundtrack, Liam creates a sense of inescapability. We are reminded, of course, we have no control over the Pequod and must let fate take its course.
There's been a lot of ways it's been done, but perhaps the most famous example is Beethoven, you know, the da-da-da-da, I think he often referred to that, or he at least once referred to that motif as the hand of fate knocking on a door.
The hand of fate doesn't so much knock on the Pequod's door as it does yank Captain Ahab back to devastating reality.
There is one knows not what sweet mystery about this sea. This gently awful stirring seemed to speak of some hidden soul beneath. The waves rise and fall and ebb and flow unceasingly. For here, millions of mixed shades and shadows, drowned dreams, reveries. All that we call lives and souls like dreams, still, like slumberers tossing in their beds.
Ahab's death is a self-fulfilling prophecy. The tragic figure is ultimately crushed not just by the whale he seeks so desperately to kill, but crushed by the weight of expectation, of his own rigid adherence to what he sees as his fate. The white whale may be just a whale, but it alludes to untold stories that have sunk to rest on the ocean floor. And it's how we, as whale hunters, readers, audience members, or theatre makers, interact with our own white whales and watery visions of fate that determines whether we sink or swim.
That story was produced by Beck Fari. Last weekend, we went in search of our own white whale.
Or any whale, really.
But as it turns out, Migaloo had already swum past Sydney, and whales are harder to spot than we first thought. Here's Mary again.
Well, we know that whaling on the East Coast went from 1788 and it probably peaked around 1850, 1860. By 1870, 80, the bottom fell out because the easy to catch ones were gone. The ones that would come up the estuary in Tasmania, in Hobart, just simply come right in front of everyone and just be slaughtered. You know, all these really easy slaughters had happened. They would have so many whales around them that it was a nuisance to try and sail. And they always knew when there was a whale in the bay because they could hear the boom from the harpoon as it would reverberate. Nowadays, if you want to see a whale, I would suggest you go to the website called Wild About Whales.
They actually have an app too, and you can use the hashtag WhaleOn to find out when they're passing through. Laura Briley Newton, who produced this next story, our Sydney Features EP and I, tried to go whale watching this past weekend at Kurnell.
If only we had a boat.
Yeah, we really need a boat. That would be great.
Alright, so we're at Solander Point, I think. And this is what we should have brought with us. Warm clothes and a blanket or a chair to sit on. Hat and sunscreen. Thermos with a hot drink or soup. Drinking water and food. Binoculars and sunglasses. A camera. Telephoto lenses are great. A species identification brochure, or this mobile app, so you can log your sightings and your patience.
And what have we brought with us?
Well, currently two of us don't have shoes, so we're not doing great on the list.
We don't have any soup.
Well, it turned out that whale watching was a bit more complicated than we thought. Laura lost her shoe in some mud, there were a bunch of black crows hanging around, it was windy, and it turned out we weren't prepared at all.
What if I logged a false sighting? Would that create a stir in the whale community?
It might.
What's the rarest whale you could spot?
Megaloosa canal.
Anyway, here's Laura's story.
If you're tempted by a slab of meat gristle, which surrendered little but an ooze of grease when chewed, then you'll love whale. Add to the sensory experience the accumulated mercury to be found in the whale meat. Consider the suffering caused by the hunt of these intelligent mammals and a military-industrial approach to their extermination. Japan going a-whaling is, to borrow from Oscar Wilde, the unspeakable in pursuit of the almost uneatable. That's not from Moby Dick, but that's lovely.
This is my dad, John Newton. He wrote a book. It's called A Savage History, Whaling in the Pacific and Southern Oceans.
Whales are extraordinarily, incredibly intelligent people, critters. They really are. They're hugely intelligent. Well, why don't I start with one that seems to really, people seem to be really surprised at this, is that in the third fleet that came here, there were five whaling boats. And that was quite interesting because the company that put them in there was a company called Enderby & Sons. And the reason that why they were interested in opening up the South Pacific to whaling was because the American Civil War had meant they couldn't go whaling in there anymore. So they decided that they would work to get the South Pacific open for whaling, which they did. And they then worked, this man Samuel Enderby, lobbied like mad to get whaling boats into the Third Fleet. So five of them came. And there's a lovely letter that Melville sent back to Enderby, which said, as we entered the heads, you could see sperm whales as far as the eye could see. Mm-hmm. So the whole of the sea. He was salivating about that because he wanted to go out and kill them.
Whales. So those boats were actually whaling boats?
They were whalers, yeah. They came in and they said, we'll drop off our human lumber, the convicts, and they went whaling.
Samuel Enderby was a London ship owner, whaler and merchant prince who founded a company named Samuel Enderby & Sons, which was, without their knowing it, hugely influential in the early history of the new colonies of the South Pacific. My dad also mentioned Melville, that's Captain Thomas Melville, no relation to Herman Melville, the writer of Moby Dick, just a complete name coincidence. Little is known about Captain Melville, though he and Captain Eber Bunker were one of the first to kill a whale in the Pacific Ocean.
So what's the story that Mum mentioned was her favourite, I think?
Oh, yes, because this is one that Bob Brown read out, which is a really sweet story. It was a story that was originally told in a book called Whaling Ship Diary, which was a 1941 book written by a Japanese man called Marukawa Hisatoshi. And he told this story about a young harpoon gunner who started working in a boat at the age of 13, and he gradually graduated to become a harpooner. This is by this time they had rifle harpoons, you know, powered harpoons. They weren't throwing them, and this guy was the gun harpooner, you know, in the Japanese fleet at the time. Anyway, he grew up, got married, and his wife gave birth to a son, which made him very happy. But then after the birth, he went back to whaling and went back to being this gun harpooner, and they were chasing a whale, and when they got closer to this whale, they discovered what they thought were two whales were actually three. There were two adults and a baby whale. So he shot the whale, and then the crew was very pleased, and then something happened. Then he was asked to shoot the other whale, the mother. So because he was a harpooner, he didn't think he shot the mother. And as that happened, then something really extraordinary happened. As he watched, he noticed that the mother whale had gone to the side of the calf, the baby calf whale, tapped it on the head with her fin, and then it was covered in something white. She released her mother's milk. As she died, she released her mother's milk so the baby would have something to eat. The nice part of the story is that after that, he gave up whaling. The other whale, the other story that people love is the story about the killer whales of Eden.
That's my favourite.
That's a lovely one. Well, it's lovely, but it's pretty cruel. Very briefly, the story is that the whaling station in Eden was a what they call a bay whaling station. So they weren't out on the high seas, right, with their boats sending out whaling ships. But what they'd do is they'd row out from the shore when the whales came close. The reason they knew the whales came close, that there was a pod of killer whales in the area. And when the whales were coming up the coast, going north for their breeding, the killer whales would alert the whalers. Three of them would swim to shore and squeak and squeal. So the whalers would then get into their boats and row out for the whales. And the other killer whales herded the whales closer to the boats so the whalers could harpoon them.
But they did that for a reward.
The reward was the lips and the tongue.
Yeah.
The lovely thing I learned about it is that there were indigenous whalers on these whaling ships, because they were highly highly praised, the indigenous whalers, because they had great eyesight and they were very accurate with the harpoon. And it turns out that the killer whales were a totem to the local Aboriginal people. So they communicated, and that was probably they were helping their totem to kill the whales. Dreamt of Moby Dick, the great white whale, cruising about with a flag flying with an inscription on it. I am what is left of wild nature, an Ahab pursuing in a jet boat with a ray gun and jet harpoons.
What a read.
That poem was by Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who was an American poet, painter, liberal activist, and co-founder of City Lights Booksellers and Publishers, which was used by the Beats as their headquarters when they were in San Francisco.
What I found when I was writing the book is the early part, when I was writing about the whalers who would go away for 3 years at a time. They'd leave places like Nantucket or Europe and they'd just sail away. And what they would do is they followed paths where they knew the whales would be. How it worked was, when they sighted a whale, they'd scream out, "She blows," they'd lower these little tiny, skinny, flimsy wooden boats. They'd all get in and they had to be very quiet, and they had to row quietly up to the whale, because the whale was very sensitive. But if they rowed up at a certain angle, because the whale has eyes on each head, so if they didn't have very good sight, so they could, and they had to get right up. I mean, imagine you'd be this wall, the height of the wall. You had to get that close to the whale, and then one man would throw a harpoon, and if that harpoon stuck, they had to let out the cord, tie it around a little thing in the front of the boat, a little pommel, and they took off on what they call the Nantucket sleigh ride, and the whale would just roar off. And they could do 35 kilometres across the water. And then sometimes they dive. So the boat dives too. And that could go on for kilometres.
What would happen to the men when the boat dived?
They would be thrown out of the boat. Sometimes, and it wasn't only Moby Dick who turned around and attacked the boat, they turn around and attack the boat. And of course, sperm whales have teeth, big teeth. So they could chew the boat up.
So it was a fair fight.
It was reasonably fair, except the whales lost more often. There was a wonderful whale called Mocha Dick, who was the model for Moby Dick. And Mocha Dick is very well known for attacking and sinking boats. But then, as I said, you couldn't help but root for the whale. It was a boat called the John Day, and we don't know the name of the skipper. And he vowed, like Ahab in Moby Dick, to catch and kill the infamous Mocha Dick, which was this big white whale. It was a white whale. It was a huge white whale. In the South Atlantic, near the Falkland Islands, Mocha Dick broke the surface about 100 metres from the John Day. And immediately, skipper said, "Lower the boats." So they lowered three boats. They gave chase, and they managed to harpoon the whale, which dragged them along for around 4 kilometres. Suddenly, after this, Mocha Dick turned and charged at the boats, smashed into the harpoon broadside, swimming over the pieces with his flukes. Two of the crew were killed, either drowned or bitten by Mocha Dick. The whale now lay a little way back, waiting to see what was going to happen next. He just sat there going, waiting for them. Not wanting to give up, the second boat approached and launched another harpoon. Mocha Dick dived and surfaced beneath the third boat, throwing it into the air, end over end. This time, no one was killed, but they didn't try again.
So he never caught Mokadik?
He never caught Mokadik. One of the stories that thought about this was, has Mokadik killed in 1859, having come to the aid of a distressed cow whale whose calf had been slain. The point is, whether he was a single whale or was a legend born out of many stories of attacks by aggressive bird whales, you know, you really don't know. Oh, this is nice. Let this be the last word. In 1926, an anonymous Japanese professor at the Pan Pacific Science Congress held in Tokyo said, "In what day shall we, on our Pacific voyage, enjoy the sight of blessed and peaceful whales around our steamer, thanking us for our generous humanity?" That was in 1926.
That's all the best producer Laura Briley Newton talking to her dad, who's written a book full of stories about the history of whaling in Australia. Turns out it's far more recent than we expected. This episode of All the Best was produced at FBI Radio in Sydney in association with Sid in Melbourne and 4ZZZ in Brisbane. Thanks to Beck Fiery and Laura Briley Newton for producing stories for today's show. Our features executive producers are Heidi Pett and Jessica Callahan. Our community coordinator is Pitt Rasmussen. Our executive producer is Jordana Caputo. And I'm Michaela Morgan. All the Best is played across Australia on the Community Radio Network, and it's made possible by the Community Broadcasting Foundation.
This American Life does that all the time. Whenever those happy coincidences occur, I'm like, mm-hmm. Okay. Hey Heidi, what's that over there? Yeah. Is that a whale? Oh my god, it's a whale!
Oh, actually though, what is that?
Oh no.
No, it's alright, it's just the rocks on the headland.
Rabbit, whale, potato, potato. Oh, I see it. It's just sitting there.